Okay. All right. So welcome, everyone, to the September 29, 2021 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. And Craig, if you would take the role, please.
Sure. The names I have so far, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Ann Hendricks, Beck Martin, Bern Tishman, Lawrence Fine, Jessica Coco, Carl Golovin, Lynn Cornelison, Marty McGee, let me just see here, I guess there's a second page, hold on, Pat O'Connell, Peter Ketchum, Gary Severson, and Tom Wilcutt. Did I miss anybody or give a name that represents somebody else being actually on the call, or is that good? I guess it's good.
Sounds like you've got everyone, yeah. Okay. And Craig, do you want to talk now about the listserv email that you're trying to get together or later?
Yeah, sure. We might as well mention that now.
Okay.
Yeah, Cheryl was asking me about, so what do we have to do to get the listserv going? And I went back into the listserv because I had sort of forgotten because it had been a while, but not only is it sort of up and going, but we have a whole bunch of people listed as members. But there seems to be something not working because we're seeing, I see in my inbox things from Kat McGuire, who's a member, but I'm not seeing too much from other people, but also it's not saying that it's from, the group listserv. It just kind of gives the person's name, so you don't really realize that it's a post on the listserv. It looks like it's just an email from an individual. So I have to figure out exactly how to fix that. And I know there are a couple of people who are part of our group who are pretty savvy about Google stuff. So I'm going to be talking to those people and get this fixed so that when somebody makes a post, those who are members will. It'll come in and people will know that this is the listserv and not just kind of a mass email from a person. And I'm not quite sure if the reason that it's mostly Kat is because other people don't realize that they can go in there. I'm not really sure. But anyway, once and for all, I've been dragging on way too long, but once and for all, we're going to get this set up and running, and I'll get somebody who knows what they're doing to help me out, and we'll get it going ASAP.
Okay, thanks, Craig. Yeah. Okay, and now let's approve the June minutes, and I want to thank Anne so much for writing them up and her patience with Craig and I when we sometimes delay on getting things to her. So really appreciate her work on all of this. So are there any objections to the June 2021 minutes as written and shared? Hearing none, they're approved.
Let me mention one other thing, if you don't mind, Cheryl.
No, go ahead.
For Anne's benefit, I once again apologize for my causing delays. But what Cheryl and I have talked about, and we're gonna implement immediately, is I'm gonna make sure that we both have equal ability to get at the recordings and the report that Free Conference Call sends us, so that you won't have any more delays. You can get it from either one of us, and you won't have this problem anymore. So we're gonna, it's ridiculous that I kind of let this drag. So we're gonna get that fixed, and then you'll be able to get that from either one of us, or we'll get you on the reports that come in. We'll get you added to that so that it automatically comes to you, and you don't have to ask.
Sure.
Anyway, just letting you know.
Thanks, Craig.
Okay.
Thank you.
My apologies.
Okay, so, all right, thanks for that, Craig. And then before we approve the agenda, I just want to explain why we have our first speaker, Tom Wilcutt, then we have the announcements, and then Richard Gage is our second speaker. We put the announcements in the middle because Richard is at another meeting and may be arriving late, so we wanted to give him time. He'll get here as soon as he can. Okay, so that's why that's in that order. And are there any objections to the agenda as written and shared? Okay, hearing none, then the agenda is approved, and we'll get started with our first speaker, which is local here in Connecticut attorney, Tom Wilcutt, and Ann is going to introduce him. Ann, go ahead.
Thank you. Tom Wilcutt is a trial attorney. He's the founding partner of Wilcutt and Habib in Hartford. He handles complex civil litigation matters with a special focus on securities fraud and banking litigation, where he regularly litigates against the large banks of Wall Street. Because of his background in science, Wilcutz also has handled numerous cases involving complex issues of science or engineering, where it has been his job to cross-examine the top-flight experts hired for such cases. He has also done a great deal of research on vaccine safety, and he'll be presenting on that tonight. Thank you, Tom, for talking to me.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom, before you get started, I'm going to put us in lecture mode so that you won't have any interruptions, okay? And then I've got to unmute you, Tom, so bear with me a moment. Okay, you're unmuted, so go ahead, Tom.
Okay, thanks, Cheryl. So I'm going to start by saying how it is that I got drawn into this topic. I've been a regular follower of Kevin Barrett's work, and I've been on his show probably half a dozen times, and we keep up regular correspondence. And Kevin has made no secret that he is a fan of Ron Unz's what we call blowback theory. And that theory is that the COVID pandemic is a consequence of a U.S. Bioweapons attack on China that was undertaken by rogue elements of neocons that was designed to undermine China's booming economy, and that it failed to achieve that goal, not only failed to achieve that goal, but also accidentally and unintentionally blew back on the United States. So that's a theory that I have many problems with, and I tried to convince Kevin that it's wrong, and I did so sort of casually in email. And I was surprised that I couldn't turn him on that, but he did invite me on his show to discuss it, and I told him that before I would do that, I would take a deep dive into the subject and try to write up a paper comparable to what Ron had written up. And in doing that work, first of all, I was optimistic about finishing that. I have a full-time practice, so. And I'm sort of a perfectionist when it comes to a writing project, so I'm still working on that. But I've pretty much completed my research, and not only did I come up with what I wanted to in order to undercut Ron's theory, but in doing this work, I came up with my own alternate theory, which I think better explains the facts, and I'm going to present that tonight. It is a false flag theory, which, of course, many people have about this. And in doing that work, I shared it with Cheryl, whom I've known for some time, and she invited me on, so that's why I'm here tonight. And I want to say that this is the second COVID project I took on during the lockdown when we had all that free time. I got involved in a debate over whether the virus evolved in nature or came out of a lab, and I did then write a very detailed research paper on that, relying heavily on my science background, which includes a degree in biophysics from Rice University, where I graduated as an undergrad, and I got invited to present my findings with a panel that included Kevin Barrett. He hosted a panel presentation back in May of 2020 that included Ron Unz. It was actually the first time I interacted with Ron, and Francis Boyle, Merrill Nass, and Barry Kissen. And I was also asked to present to this group, which I did over a year ago, for anyone who might remember. I will say that I'm gratified that I think my thesis was proven correct in the main media, in the main sort of discourse. That didn't really surprise me. What surprised me a little is that they would come to the point where they admitted that the statements that it was definitively evolved from nature were erroneous. So anyway, real quick on Ron's blowback theory, I don't think it fits the facts. I think it's comparable to the 9/11 blowback theory with the idea that we funded the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda, or backed them to fight the Russians in Afghanistan, and we unwittingly created the circumstances that led to 9/11, and that's the referred to the 9/11 blowback theory, where the ruling elite just happened to stumble upon all the riches they desired from that event, where it's written off to dumb luck by the likes for a second I've lost the name of our famous liberal commentator. But in any case, there are a number of people who embrace that theory. But my feeling is that when you're trying to analyze what the bad guys are doing, in my experience, it's best to try to put yourself in their shoes and get into their heads. And that's how I go about performing analysis of 9/11, or in this case, the COVID pandemic. And I found a number of facets to my background useful in that regard. I come from a military family, and as in my youth, I was a student of military history. I'm a tournament chess player, and I have sparred with Wall Street for several decades, and all of those experiences involve understanding your opponent's moves, trying to understand what they're doing, and looking ahead at their future moves. So this is the type of analysis I try to apply to these type of situations. In this case, the first thing you need to do is to find who the bad guys are. Now, in Ron's theory, he's got rogue neocons. But the real, in my estimation, like many others, the top of the pyramid, I think, are the international bankers like the Rothschilds and Rockefellers. I like to refer to the famous Kissinger quote where he says, if you control food, you can control people, you control oil, you can control nations, you control currency, and you control everything. You can add to that control information, but I think that is at the top of the pyramid, and I think there's a many indicia of that, including the central banking system where private central banks control the currency of nations, and the central banks essentially sit above nations. You have the famous Rothschild quote, give me control of a nation's currency, and I care not who makes the laws. So anyway, that's who I think you have to look at when you see a world-changing event like this. I just don't think ideologues like neocons have any meaningful power. I think they are the mere tools of the rulers. And they play their role. Obviously, they played an important role in 9/11, but I think they're functionaries in this regard. I think particularly insightful is the interview Aaron Russo gave, the film producer behind Trading Places, who befriended one of the Rockefellers, who he later recounted how this Nicholas Rockefeller foretold the 9/11 attack to him, indicating it would be a major ruse and fraud, and it would be world-changing. And he also indicated that the real goal down the road, when they'll really have control, is when they get people chipped, fitted with chips. And I think that goal you're seeing unfold in the aftermath of this pandemic. They haven't got there yet, but that's the direction I think they're heading. So the next question is, well, what is the goal of the ruling elite? And I think in this regard, all you really need to do is look at their own writings. Again, you can refer to David Rockefeller. He made no secret about the goal of one world government. and having the laws of nations give way to international law and international control. Now, in this respect, you can look at their writings, and I recommend a young fellow I recently got familiar with when I was doing my research. His name is Jay Dyer, and he does a great job of going back all the writings that can be linked to the ruling elite and what they have to say about their vision of the future. And there's always this interest in controlling the masses. I mean, their numbers are very small. There's billions of people. So there's always a question of control. And there's also an obsession with population control. In so many of the writings of the ruling elite, you see this theme, which is also often coupled with eugenics. So in my opinion, all these goals are served by what we're seeing unfold in this pandemic. So another observation I'll make is when the ruling elite finds something that works, they stick with it. An example of that would be lone nut assassins, you know, Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, James Earl Ray. When you have a formula that works, there's no reason to deviate. In the case of 9/11 and the pandemic, one of the methods that has served well in bringing about success is wargaming these events in advance. Now, I probably don't have to tell this audience is probably very familiar with the wargaming with 9/11, but there was substantial wargaming of this pandemic, and I don't think that's a coincidence. In 2019 alone, there were two major war games. One was called Crimson Contagion that was put on by every number of major federal agencies, including the Department of Defense and Homeland Security. And what's better known is Event 201, which was sponsored in part by the World Economic Forum, Davos, and, of course, the Gates Foundation, where they're basically modeling exactly what unfolded. So, again, I don't think that type of advanced planning can be written off to a coincidence. And another similarity between 9/11, a major similarity, 9/11 and the pandemic, is you have documents that write up and state the goals of what you need to achieve. In 9/11, it was the Project for New American Century setting out the goals and prophetically stating that they would need a new Pearl Harbor to bring it out. With the pandemic, there was a major paper written and published by the Rockefeller Institute in 2010 that discussed various scenarios that would alter the fundamental nature of world governance. And one of those four scenarios was a pandemic scenario, which was under the heading lockstep. And I'm going to quote from that. And again, this is a scenario that came out of the Rockefeller Institute Foundation. A world of tighter top-down government control and more authoritarian leadership with limited innovation and growing citizen pushback. Now, and then during the course of describing this, there's another quote where they're describing how this unfolds. And again, quoting, the Chinese government's quick imposition and enforcement of mandatory quarantine for all citizens, as well as its instant and near hermetic sealing off of all borders, saved millions of lives, stopping the spread of the virus far earlier than in other countries and enabling a swifter post-pandemic recovery. Now, I think that quote, running a scenario for a pandemic is key to what we're seeing here, because I think one of the successes of this pandemic is to hold up China as a role model that the West needs to mimic and embrace in order to better deal with the virus. And I would say with this one world governance and dispensing with nation states, you cannot dispense with nation states when you have strong constitutional republics in place like the United States, as well as other republics in the English tradition, like Australia and Canada, which are suffering brutal restrictions. So let me move to what I view as a laundry list of benefits to the ruling of elite. We're seeing a redaction of freedoms and liberties that go well beyond what we saw in 9/11 and the Patriot Act. Unprecedented restrictions on movement and businesses, unprecedented censorship, upcoming digital passports and other type new control mechanism. And I think what is the ultimate control is mandatory vaccines. Once the state has the power to compel an injection, you have no meaningful rights at that point. And it's interesting that Biden and Harris themselves modeled this point when they said that they would not trust the Trump vaccine. And what they're saying is there is that I wouldn't hand myself over to this guy and allow him to have this control over my life. Well, that's the whole point. When you give up this power to the state, the power that when the state decides to inject you with something that they can do it, you don't get to pick and choose whom you trust. It's who's ever in power who has that right. And this is the precedent that's being set. And you know, and Biden, in a recent address to the nation, admitted this goal of supplanting constitutional rights and freedoms. This is a direct quote from Biden. It is not a matter of freedom or individual liberty, and describing why we need to have these vaccinations. And I think that's one of Biden's rare true statements in making that characterization of what's unfolding. The other benefits, I would refer people to Catherine Austin Fitz has gone into some detail about how the pandemic also enable resetting the currency and switching to a digital currency. That is a major achievement that this pandemic can provide the cover for. Also, there's the bringing on AI control. And I would refer to Whitney Webb's work on this. She does a real good job on it. And both of these, both Fitz's currency and this AI control, all fits under the general heading of the Great Reset, which I'm sure everyone's heard about. Whitney actually does a piece where there was a white paper that was disclosed where a combination of the Pentagon, the intelligence services, and big tech referred to the need to mimic China's advances in AI in this respect. Ron's theory that the code was designed to hurt the economy of China is such small potatoes compared to these larger issues. Now, in my theory, China is the key to the COVID pandemic false flag. The international bankers, particularly the Rockefellers, have prepped China for its present role for many decades. Their influence and intervention in China goes back 100 years, and I recommend James Cormann's work on that. He goes into considerable detail about how China has been developed for the role that they're playing. If you look at that history up to the present, it's obvious that Wall Street is playing a very significant role in converting China from an impoverished communist nation to a capitalistic juggernaut. That wasn't a function of China's own merit. That was a function of their being supported to get in that position. And the reason for doing that is China becomes the model for the one world government. As I quoted in the Rockefeller paper, China's held for having implemented draconian authoritarian lockdowns at work. That's the key, and even Ron embraced that. In his theory, he says, our attack failed on China because it did such a great job and we did such a miserable, incompetent job. So he's actually being pulled in by that, the goal of holding up China as the model to emulate. And another thing, before I did my recent deep dive in the pandemic, there were three things that did not make sense to me that now made sense. And Cheryl, I know I'm coming up on the 20-minute mark. I probably do have about 5 more minutes, if that's okay.
Yeah, you have 5 minutes. Yep.
Okay. So in any case, when I did my first deep dive into the virus, one of the things that did make sense to me was the history that had recently occurred with gain-of-function research. And what did not make sense is how it got shut down by the U.S. And the way that happened is in 2014, there were purportedly separate lab leaks of three dangerous pathogens from CDC labs. And what was odd about that is that the CDC came forward, announced this failure, and asked for a commission to review it. Now, that's not typically something that an institution does in reaction to a screw-up. Usually you try to hide your screw-ups, you don't publicize them, and you don't ask for an outsider to review your procedures and tell you how to run your operation. But that's what happened here. And not only did this odd occurrence happen with the CDC, where they invited review of their gain-of-function projects, but an impressive group of scientists came together and wrote this letter extending the same criticism and questioning whether this should take place at all and asking for it to be reviewed. And then Obama very swiftly reacted to these circumstances by shutting off a gain-of-function research, which then led Fauci to refunneling that research to Wuhan. So this is important because this whole narrative that in this pandemic is based upon the virus originating in Wuhan. And actually, I went back and looked back into this. The support for that is very weak. And in fact, a paper just came out that indicates that the virus was circulating in the United States and Europe months before China, which also connects with the numbers that I found confusing at the beginning. It didn't make sense to me that China was ground zero, and then we saw the numbers that we saw in China. So the gain-of-function, this gain-of-function history, so after they reviewed gain-of-function, they said, okay, they came up with a meaningless set of guidelines that said, if you follow these guidelines, it's okay, and they resumed it. So that odd, inexplicable occurrence of shutting down something that our government loves to do, but it all led to funding and diversion of this to China, which sets up China for this virus. Another thing that I got to say that never made sense to me was Trump winning the election when he was so stringently opposed by the deep state. And but there's a paper by Pepe Escobar where he got a source, what he calls one of the masters of the universe in Wall Street, who explained that the reason for their choosing Trump is that they've lived on these profits of shifting industry abroad for so long, but they need to bring it back to the United States, and that's the purpose he's going to serve. So in any case, and Trump later described himself as the chosen one, referring to his role of bringing back the United States versus China. So when the virus, at the start of the pandemic, Trump's the perfect guy to blame the virus, the China virus. He really embraces the narrative, and everyone just goes along with it. No one even questions whether this is correct. It's just assumed to be true. And so he serves sort of that purpose. Now, one of the, you know, and also I got to give credit to Whitney Webb. She came up with a theory, and I looked at this, and it does make sense, where one of the things that helped say that the virus originates in China is you had these people seemingly falling and dying in the streets. And you also had the Iranian leadership remarkably dying in the numbers that they perished, all blamed on the virus. Her theory is, and I think it's a very interesting theory, is that this was all consistent with fentanyl poisoning, which is a Mossad assassination poison of choice, which does look like it emulates natural causes and can mimic a respiratory death like we've seen here. Now, the other big thing with so
Tom, two minutes left.
Yeah, sure. Also with China, there's the we're still pushing this phony war with China, and the purpose that serves, and again, this is Whitney Webb's work, is that by being engaged in this war footing with China, that will be an excuse for us needing to fight that war successfully to emulate their methods, including AI and social control. And Kissinger has some great quotes on this. The other thing is that the whole setting China up like this is kind of similar to 9/11, where Saudi Arabia supposedly supplied the hijackers, Pakistan, the money, and we were able to hold that over both their heads. With China, we hold the virus over their heads. If China does not play ball, we can always come forward with what we call definitive proof that it came out of their lab. But I think it's clear that China is playing ball. The Chinese premier was introduced by Klaus Schwab at the last Davos meeting, where he supplied the opening address. And what the Chinese premier said in that address is consistent with going along with this entire false flag, just like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan went along with it in comparison. So that covers it. That's the alternate theory, and where China is the major player. So with that, I'm happy to address any questions.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Let me put us in the Q&A mode. Yes.
Can I just interrupt quickly? Tom, are you comfortable that you had enough time to finish your presentation? Because I'm prepared to make a motion that we add a little bit of time, if that would be beneficial to you, like another 5 minutes or another.
Well, the only thing, I had a few more comparisons to 9/11, which I don't think are too significant. I mean, in both cases, you had pre-knowledge with insider trading, and you had your typical cooperation between the deep state and private industries. 9/11, it was a military-industrial complex. And this, in the pandemic, it's big pharma, where enormous profits are made in each case, which makes it easier to get the cooperation of the private industries involved. But
would adding another five be a good thing for you, or do you want to take questions?
No, that really on my outline, I did reach the end. But there are okay. I can cover some more detail perhaps in the Q&A. So we'll see.
Great, perfect.
Okay, thanks, Craig. Okay, so I'm going to switch us into Okay, so if you want to ask a question, again, it's *6. And Tom, I'm going to unmute you. So just a moment, you're unmuted. Okay. So again, any questions for Tom, *6. And we'll take a moment and wait while people sign up for that. Tom, while we're waiting for people to get in the queue, have you talked to Ron Unz about your thoughts on this, and what is his response?
No, I personally emailed him several times, and you know, it may be, you know, he never responded, but it's funny because somehow I got on his list, and I received some email from him, but they're just mass, you know, emailings he makes to whoever is on his list,
mm-hmm.
I guess. So And well, you know, I think I offered it to Kevin Barrett to debate him, but and that, I don't think that went anywhere.
Okay. All right. Thanks. All right. So our first question is from Carl Gullivan. Carl, go ahead.
So, Carl, myself. Hi. Yes, yeah, so Tom, thank you for your presentation. I, a frequent contributor at UNS Report is French author Laurent Guyenot, G-U-Y-E-N-O-T. I was going to recommend to you his book, From Yahweh to Zion. And in partly due to that book, I'm persuaded that Zionism, of course, is more than a Talmudic, Judaic concept. It's well, I think, accepted in the, well, in the higher echelons of Catholicism and Reformed Christianity, evangelical Christian Zionists. And so looking in the greater scheme of things where central banking, the Rothschilds, the, well, let's say the chief priests and the Pharisees are essentially the power above all. And even soon after the formation of Israel, Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, first president or prime minister, said that, you know, within a few generations that the Supreme Court of mankind would sit in Jerusalem. And, of course, part of the Zionist scheme long-term is the destruction of borders among nations and, you know, Jerusalem as the center of the world. Now, it's a bit unpalatable to discuss, but the Talmud and even just the scriptures describe clearly the distinction between the chosen people and the rest of the world and need to, quote, manage that rest of the world, the Gentiles. And arguably, a global mandated vaccine system, even with embedded chips to track who's been vaccinated and who hasn't, is just a very credible concept to work towards managing population through limiting fertility, for example. There's already talk that the COVID shot may have an effect on women's ovaries, reducing fertility. And so I wonder if it just goes really get back to that basic world governance and population control concept.
Oh, I think that's a major part of this. And you touched on actually a couple points that I had included but had pared down for the 20 minutes as I thought might come out. So, again, this person I found, Jay Dyer, has done, I think, some very good work on this, and he goes back through the writings. I am familiar with the From Yahweh to, I can't remember the balance, but
Zion.
Yeah, okay. And he was interviewed recently by Kevin, and I caught that. And I think he's done good work. I don't put Zionism at the level that a lot of people do. I think the Zionists exist and have their particular goals. And I think to the extent, like the neocons, I think to the extent that they match the goals of the ruling elite, they become a useful tool. I think Israel is a useful tool. But I don't think it's a goal in itself. The best research I've seen is that the one ideology, if you want to call it that, that the ruling elite embraces Darwinism, to where they are the survival of the fittest, where that's who they are, and they're above the normal masses, and that explains and justifies their control and so forth. But population control, I think, is clearly, I mean, if you put there, again, by putting yourself in the shoes of the bad guys and trying to get inside their heads, if you're one of these ruling elite who think yourself above everyone, what need do you have of 9 billion people in the world? Well, you know, it seems to me that with their mindset, they would naturally prefer a Garden of Eden type earth, and where they don't, and with the advancement of AI and robotics, they're simply not going to need large numbers of people in the future. I think that it's possible that the virus and the vaccination have some of these qualities, like you mentioned, infertility. That certainly remains to be seen. But if they don't have them now, the real point is that you've set up a system where that's available to you any time you want. It would probably be safer to treat it as a beachhead, to get your foot in the door, to where in the, you know, get the people used to it and accepting of it in the first instance. And once they're complacent, then you can do whatever you want. I mean, it's like, you know, same thing with 9/11. You slowly get people used to the intrusions on privacy and so forth, to where when it comes out, oh, you were really overstepping the bounds. Oh, well, who cares? We're not going to change it at this point. And I have to tell you, if you go back to the original Rothschild, the original cast there, and international and the bankers in general, the one, you know, one thing they didn't have is their own country. They learned to control nations, but there were many occasions where the nobles of the country got so upset that the monarch had to take care of them and would cancel debts and kick the bankers out. And so I think having their own nation state, their own nuclear weapons, their own intelligence agencies, instead of working through other nations, I think that was just a key component of their power and control.
Right. I've also wondered whether those same interests have been inclined to shift the balancing global power to China and the Chinese model, you know, versus the American model. Of course, that fits with what you were saying, I believe.
Absolutely. I think that's the whole, that's what we're seeing here. And the thing is that China's not a real threat to create some independent global dominance. China doesn't, it's really not part, as Kissinger explains, it's really not part of their culture. They have this sense of superiority that's innate, and they don't have to conquer other people. In fact, it's sort of against them to mix with others and to go outside the great China borders. You know, that's just not what they do. And when you go back to the Kissinger quote about food and oil and currency, and Kevin, in embracing Ronnott's theory, says China is going to supplant the U.S. as a great empire. I don't think there's any much risk of that at all. I mean, China doesn't control food, it doesn't control oil, and it doesn't control currency. It doesn't control any of the big three. You know, when you look at Wall Street and the bankers set up China, it was more than just using cheap labor. They went way beyond that. They really gave China everything they needed to prop them up. And David Rockefeller explained that back in the 70s, that he just was in awe of their social control. And that social control is what they want to import to the Western constitutional republics and really do away with those constitutional liberties by using China as the model to do that. And it will not only be the pandemic, it will be that China has been so successful and we're in a war footing with China, and so just for our security, we need to match their methods. You know, just
thank
like you,
you
have an arms race with Russia. Anyway, so.
Thanks, Tom.
That was, yep.
Okay, thanks, Carl. Next question is from Jessica Coco. Jessica, go ahead.
I guess mine is a little bit of a twofold question. One of them is, are you saying that the virus is real first as opposed to 5G or something else? And second, the question that's never been really asked is the issue of we're in the second Great Depression. And I guess the question is, how are they going to prevent the depression? How are they going to get everyone microchipped so that they can cull us in time before the whole economy collapses?
Well, I think just like the bankers ramped up China's economy, they can do that with any economy at any time they choose to do. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we've had such advancements in technology where everything can be created, whether it's food or housing or whatever it is, it can be created more quickly and efficiently. So the idea of there being deprivation is only by choice. And it's all a function of the money, to my understanding, okay? So I think they want to bring about this great reset, and it's part of the great reset is with the advancements of AI, they're going to need labor less and less and less. And so I think the idea of giving people the basic income, UBI, universal basic income, it is a great control tool because so you digitize the currency and you give people their allotment that the state is totally in control of. And if the masses get out of line, you can just throw a switch and not only eliminate that income, but money sitting in accounts, you can also completely zero anytime you want. And this is going to be one of the other facets of the ultimate social control. You'll have a social score system. This is what I think they're modeling in China that they want to bring over here as well. So if you have bad tweets or, you know, other politically incorrect actions or statements or interactions, you can be dialed down as punishment. So that's what I think is happening with that part of it. I do think they're going to reset the currency. We have these enormous debts, but debt is an illusion. Debt is all in the hands of the bankers, okay? It's an ultimate control system. Anytime they want to, quote, reset the currency, switch it off to a digital, They'll say we have this catastrophic debt, and the only way we can possibly get out of it is to make these currency switches, and people will accept it just to avoid what you're describing, a depression. I mean, that depression in the 30s was entirely a power grab by the bankers. I mean, typically the method is to flood credit out, and with the flooding of credit, properties are purchased, businesses are started, and then if you pull it back and retract it, they all go bankrupt, and all of a sudden you own all those properties and you own all those businesses. So this is a tried and true method. It can be done, it can be turned on and off at any time, and I think that that's the kind of power that they're going to use as part of this reset. I don't know how helpful that was, but... you might have had a two-part question. I'm not sure I hit both parts.
Oh, is the virus real?
Oh, well, the virus is so benign. If it's real, it's so benign that you can treat that. Look, there are many coronaviruses out there. Okay, so. When they do these tests and they say you have you're infected with the COVID, I mean, they can come to that conclusion with anyone they want because we all have coronaviruses in our bodies. So the short answer is I don't know the answer to that. Okay, I mean. There are a number of experts who seem to be, you know, independent and not part of a control narrative, who seem to believe that it is a real virus. And I'm not sure how much it matters. I've seen the case made against the whatchamacallit, the real my old age, I lose track. What's the virus that was the sexually transmitted one that was so dangerous for so long? AIDS. So AIDS, the evidence I've seen on AIDS is much stronger than that was contrived. The HIV and AIDS, I've seen some really good work on that. But I can't say the same about this COVID-19. I don't know enough one way or the other.
Okay, Jessica, you all set?
Yes.
Oh, Tom, did you want to say more?
Well, I haven't made the effort to do the deep dive into that. I'm not sure if I did, it would supply the answer, but I haven't gone to that trouble. I mean, I when they said that, if it does exist, I'm nearly certain it was lab created, but whether there's a sleight of hand there, I couldn't say for sure.
Okay, all set, Jessica. Thank you. Okay, Anne Hendricks is next. Anne, go ahead.
Hi, Tom. I see you have a background also in philosophy, and I would just like to know what is your understanding about why would they plan decades in advance or even longer for these things? Why do this agenda go? Why does it go out decades in advance? Or I mean, maybe even more than a century, some would say. How can these people serve this cause? What do you suppose they would be gaining from it personally?
Just power. Power and control is what I say.
For the grandchildren? I mean, say for instance, there was a whistleblower from WHO. So she was talking about something that was actually due to be, the planning was for 2050. So who are they thinking about, the grandchildren? Or are they serving some other power? What is their reward? Well, even the Rockefellers.
Well, there is a theory that it's a satanic cult, and you know, the best evidence that I've seen is that there's not really a religion attached to it. That it is a view of human beings strictly as animals, and that, you know, again, the one principle they seem to embrace is Darwinism. And it's funny because of some of the people who have written, you know, you want to talk about a philosopher. One of the philosophers I studied in school was, what's that guy's name? Bertrand Russell, okay? Now, he was considered a philosopher worth studying as part of my degree, although his field was mathematical logic. But I never realized that he was part of the British Royal Society, and he was a ruling elite insider. And he wrote some very revealing stuff in answer to your questions, in terms of what their goals are. And the goal is a ruling technocracy. And by the way, this is what James Corbett, how he describes the Chinese model. They're not modeling socialism or communism, they're modeling a technocracy. And Bertrand Russell had some writings that go back to the 1930s where he describes how there will be an international order, nation states will be done away with, people might be allowed to believe that they're in a democracy, but they'll be totally hoodwinked. And we'll have society run by elite technocrats, and the masses will be pacified, and they will be, you know, told what to do, and they'll comply. So there's all these dystopian works that are predicting the future that we're seeing come about. Now, the idea of why would a person rationally do, I mean, there's lots of things we do for our children and grandchildren. I mean, we do it for ourselves for a point. I'm sure they do, but they see it as a birthright that they then pass on, I think. So I think that is the answer as far as that goes.
Okay. Another thing, you said that the ruling elite embraces Darwinism, survival of the fittest. So really, if they truly believed that, then they wouldn't bother with the depopulation because they would assume that the fittest only will be surviving.
So as long as well as Birch, well, right, but well, no, they see themselves as having a controlling hand in that, okay? And where Bertrand Russell, to me, was a surprise, another big surprise is Jonas Salk. If you try to find this book, you won't be able to find it without paying hundreds of dollars for it, which is amazing because why would a book that he wrote that's in demand be so hard to get? It's called Survival of the Wisest. And Salk talks about, going back decades, talks about using viruses and mRNA to control population. And he talks about how the traditionalists will need to be done away with. And he's saying in the nature of things, you know, you had pestilence and war and these type of things to control population. And with those things being eliminated, they're going to have to embrace other methods for controlling population. And this is Jonas Salk, the kind, wise inventor of vaccines, okay, who's speaking diabolically in some of what he writes. And just the title of his book, Survival of the Wisest, he's talking about the elite are the ones that will run the world, and they will take care of the population problem, which he makes no bones about discussing and describing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Anne, thank you. And I think, Tom, I have the last question, unless anyone else, no one is in the queue now, but so I'm just going to ask it, and we'll I assume it's the last question. And I don't know if you can answer this, but I'm very curious about the fact that Israel has been the country most vaccinated in the world, from what I understand, and a lot of the people are now, you know, having problems with that and getting sick, and they're actually rebelling. But I'm curious to know, why do you think, because I'm sure all of this is planned, why do you think they would want to take out the Israeli citizens themselves? I'm kind of confused by that, and I'm just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, my immediate thought is that the ruling elite care no more for the people of Israel than they do any other lesser peoples. I mean, again, I don't think the Zionists are part of the club. Okay, I think it was to the benefit of the ruling elite to have the state of Israel, and I think that will continue to be the case. Until it's not the case, if it were ever not the case, I don't think they'd have any problem of letting it fall by the wayside. I don't think they care about the people. The idea that they did this, I mean, look, whatever you think you know about this vaccine, you're not really going to know until you properly test it on human beings. Now, historically, the test subjects for all kinds of testing were either, you know, minorities in the case of Tuskegee or military servicemen in the case of, you know, the anthrax vaccine, the vaccine other, they had a swine flu vaccine problem in the 70s. They'll test things on military people, but short of that, you're not going to really know. Now, what I understand is that, and by the way, the ruling elite might not bother with these kind of details, like how much vaccination Israel gets. So my understanding is that, what's his name, the Israeli premier who's now gone? Netanyahu made a deal with Pfizer. And that, you know, I mean, Pfizer might have bribed him. But the bottom line is, Israel was spoken of as, you know, the biggest laboratory experiment you're going to find. And it may well have been, you know, and whether it was designed to be that way or not, it served that function. And but that hasn't been a problem. I mean, because not only are they the most vaccinated, but they are the leaders in doing the boosters, which you know, Biden's trying to replicate here in the States. I don't see, if you're saying that this is a bad result for the ruling elite, I'm not sure I see that. Because what do they care whether?
Yeah, I'm not sure what I think about it, but I guess that what you're saying is what David Icke says too, that they're just being used for, you know, and when they're no longer needed, they won't care about them. So yeah.
Well, if David Icke agrees with that, I didn't know, but he mm-hmm. often I think has some good insights, so I'll live with that.
Okay, thanks. And we now do have one other question, but before we go to that one question, I do want to let people know that Barbara Honegger just called me, and she and Richard will be joining us by 9:30 at the latest, and hopefully a few minutes earlier than that. But so they will be here, just got to bear with them. So, okay, great. Then Carl Gullivan, you're next on the with the questions, and we'll cut the questions off here. So Carl has the last question.
Thank you. Tom, I'll try to phrase this as a question to you, but it's really feedback concerning the questions of both Anne and Cheryl. One is that in Guyano's book, if I'm correct in recalling, he explains that the Talmudic Judaic belief concerning an individual's soul is that individuals do not actually have an eternal soul. Their eternity exists in the people themselves and in the history of the people. So hence there's no qualm about doing something to benefit the people in their, you know, future to come, even though those outside the tribe might view it as a, you know, a reprehensible act. If it's what's best for the, you know, the chosen group, then it's not you don't have an individual soul that, you know, will be harmed by that. Which goes towards Anne's question about, you know, if these are among the ruling elite, what would be their purpose? Well, it's for the greater good of their group. And the second, concerning Cheryl's question on Israel, what do you think of the notion that, well, for one, if it's just a long-term control scheme of mandatory vaccinations and even shipping, I imagine the population of Israel probably would be participating in that. There's always propaganda. Maybe the ill effects are or aren't as bad as reported. Also, maybe the most important groups are not are given a placebo versus the, you know, what everyone else is getting. But yeah, clearly the vaccine is to some extent survivable. So, but if they inflict it upon themselves, then no one can blame them for being the enablers of the whole issue. And that was it.
Okay. Yeah. I don't see an infliction on the people of Israel as an infliction on the ruling elite. But back to that question about why they would do this, why they would look so far in the future and so forth, their grandchildren, whatever. I think the philosophy is that this is just the natural order of things. In other words, they sit above the masses and rule because they have the insights and wherewithal to do that. Not to mention, they have, I mean, if you look at the history of the British monarchy, I mean, part of being on top and ruling is ruthlessness. I mean, if you're willing to be more ruthless than the next guy, then that's one way you can win. And but whatever the, however they view how they got there, their belief has to be that they got there because they were fitter, that they're at the top because just like a strong buck who rules the herd, they're at the top because they have the necessary strengths and abilities to be at the top, that's the natural order. And, you know, I mean, if they have a weak child, you know, that child won't mean much, but part of what they do is they look for talent and they grab that talent and try to use it for their own purposes. So they're happy to find the bright people out there, no matter what level of society they come from. You see this all the time. You see people who don't come from much and they're big time functionaries, and they're happy to surround themselves with experts and technocrats and all that, but their ability to choose these people and to exploit them and just rule, they just see that as their superiority and part of the natural order, I would say so.
Thank you.
I would just back to Darwinism, as I
would. Well, and actually, Guyano in that text does discuss Darwinism, and he says the applicability is not so much in the Talmudic perspective, which is that, I mean, if one has a belief as a tribe that you are the supreme tribe, the chosen tribe to govern the whole world for all of eternity, and you can demonstrate some pretty extreme ruthlessness in, for example, the reestablishment of the political state of Israel. I think that's a kind of Darwinism that's not of the exact biological. It's the, if one believes one is a supreme group and is willing to be ruthless to maintain that, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, I suppose.
My understanding is that the original Jews were Semitic peoples, and that the ruling class among the Jews now are Europeans, and that there's a caste where the Semitic Jews are actually looked down upon in Israel. So this idea that this traces back to some original tribes, I think
you're absolutely hitting on that perspective, which is written about by, among others, Douglas Reed and the Controversy of Zion. Even Solzhenitsyn has written about this in his last book, Two Centuries Together, A History of the Jews in Russia, that Eastern European Jewry is descended from a conversion that happened back in like 7 to 1100 of the leadership and then all the people of the Khazars, who were a nomadic tribe in more or less the Ukraine area and part of Russia. During that period of time, and that, yeah, in fact, they, as Israel was being established, the Sephardic Jews suffered greatly at the hands of the Ashkenazi or Khazarian Jews, and even today, maybe the COVID shot in Zion maybe the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic get a different shot. One doesn't know.
Yeah, I think that's what the evidence supports. I agree with that.
Well, thank you for your time.
In terms of, no problem.
So, Tom, we have one other person now who would like to ask a question. So, are you up for one more question?
I'm up for as many as you like. I mean, I was planning on sticking around for Richard. So
okay. Okay. So let's do that one.
Kill the time.
Okay, so Ann Hendricks, who asked a question, has another one for you. So here she goes. Ann, go ahead.
Okay.
Hey, Tom. So I have another contradiction here. I was watching like some video, Italy videos, and thinking about how the rich love the things that, I mean, the traveling and the things that the culture, they love that, and they can afford it. They can afford to travel. They can afford to enjoy the finer things in life. So how would you balance that with whatever is the movement today to cancel culture, to put, which has been mentioned on this teleconference before?
I think cancel culture is just a control mechanism.
There's none of the fine things in life anymore, the art or the music or what they consider the fine things. If they depopulate the earth, then where are the, even the luxuries that they used to enjoy spending or enjoy?
I don't see a problem there. Okay, so when I think of cancel culture, I don't think of what I see is a campaign to undermine traditional families and to undermine reproduction the way it used, you know, would normally have. When you have all these gender those gender obfuscation. You know, supposedly the young people today, and they're taught this, that, you know, the idea of having a child or having a family is just, it's being put in lower and lower regard. But I think that's different from, you know, I mean, I don't think that affects things like music and art and theater and so forth. I think that those things can still.
Who is going to provide it for them?
Well, I don't think
who will be left
that
to provide it for them.
Well, so they talk about a population. You know, the one you hear all the time is reducing the world's population to 500 million people. Okay. 500 million people is enough for them to enjoy the things they want to enjoy. And moreover, the degradation to the environment, whether it's plastics or, I gotta tell you, my ex-wife used to love Evian water, and I never cared much for it myself, until I was handling a case down in Wall Street, and I ended up staying at the hotel down there that catered to the rich just because it was convenient, my client could afford it. And I was out on a patio, and Evian water in a bottle just tasted so much better. But all these problems with the environment, I think those are real for these people. I mean, I think they would. Just imagine this: how this country looked when it was first inhabited by Europeans compared to how it looks now. I mean, I think that they would crave that type of transformation. And with the advancement of robotics, you know, they're soon going to have, they're soon not going to need human servants, okay? But in any case, I think they can have as many people as they think they need. That's not a problem, okay? It's not like, oh, we were wrong about 500 million. So you breed, another couple hundred million, that's not going to be a limitation on them, okay? The tricky thing will be to get rid of the ones you don't want, but they're heading down that path, it seems to me. And the ultimate control mechanism for that is to get people conditioned to believe in the existence of whatever virus they declare is out there, and to condition people to accept whatever injection is needed to address this latest. Just like they had an unending source. I mean, when they said the war of terror will never be over, you know, and they can line up terrorists as long as they need to, they're going to be able to line up viruses as long as they need to, real or not, real or imagined. And once they get people conditioned to accept these treatments, which is why the propaganda is so relentless and strong on this point. And I imagine everyone on this call knows somebody who just, you know, buys into that hook, line, and sinker. And I've certainly encountered that. And it's amazing, I find. It's just truly, it's amazingly effective. So did I answer your question?
You answered it. Thank you.
Cheryl, yeah. Is it too late for me to ask a quick one at the end here?
No, go ahead, Craig, go ahead.
Okay, great. Tom, I'm sort of wondering, I'm dealing with a situation where I live where you basically need to be vaccinated to do almost anything except kind of the basics, you know, buy food, that sort of thing. If you want to go to a restaurant or if you want to go to a bar or a concert or any of those things, you have to show proof of vaccination at the door. So, and when I try to make the case for how horrific this is to people I know who live here, their reaction is not just to sort of doubt me, but to actually kind of attack me for being terribly selfish. Like, I don't care about, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of people dying just because I want to have my, you know, my selfish freedoms and rights and things like that. So they kind of mock the idea of rights, basically. And I just wonder, how do you handle that kind of a position from somebody who, I mean, they buy the whole narrative for sure, but just in terms of trying to make them understand that, you know, keeping people from living a normal life because of the vaccine is just wrong. How do you deal with that?
Well, so what I do for a living, or my training as a trial attorney, is to take a jury and educate them. And that's a delicate thing. And when I do that in my personal life, in my experience, the only way, because I've converted quite a few people on 9/11 over the years, and I use the same techniques I do when I'm educating a jury. And one of the things is to get their, I get their trust is the way I do it. So I never jump right at them with it. I always, I feel them out. You find out what's important to them. And once you find out what's important, you try to make a connection on whatever common areas that usually you have some common areas of agreement with a person. And so you establish those, you develop a rapport and trust, and then you go slowly. That's how I've always done it.
yeah.
With
going slowly is not my strong suit, I guess.
What's that?
I said going slowly is not something I'm always the best at.
I've been around 9/11 people and very few of them. Cheryl was a witness to this. We were at a deep state conference in California, and we had dinner. Cheryl had dinner with myself and my sister and my brother-in-law. And Cheryl, you remember I flipped my brother-in-law right then and there at that conference?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's funny, we were at dinner and I was trying, in this particular, my brother-in-law is an architect. So I was trying, I go, okay, he's an architect. I'm going to talk to him about the science. I mean, I have my degree in physics. So the Newtonian physics of these buildings is a very simple matter to me. And I was trying to get him to do that. And he couldn't get over. He wouldn't focus on that. He kept asking me about the terrorists and who's behind it and who did it and whatever. And I'm like, look, forget all that. Let's just look at this building. And so I was deflecting all that and trying to minimize it. And Cheryl, of course, is seeing these questions and wants to, like, give him the answers. But he's not accepting those answers. And so I finally gave up avoiding that, and I said, all right, you want to know who did it. Okay. So I go, let me tell you. It was the Pakistani ISI, and they – you know, the money transfers, you know, they had the close relationship with Al-Qaeda, blah, 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 blah. And all right, that's who did it. And he looks at me, he goes, oh, so you're saying the terrorists did it? And I go, yeah, of course. And he goes, oh. And now he started reflecting and thinking. And as we were leaving the restaurant, I said, Mark, I was just joking. I wasn't serious. That's not what I think happened, but here's what you need to reflect upon. What difference does it make which answer is right when it comes to how these buildings collapsed? And he left kind of thoughtful. And then that evening, I luckily emailed him a nice documentary about the history of propaganda in the U.S. and how it is that it's so easy to shape people's thinking on any number of events. And that was the ticket for him. And he thanked me. He goes, oh, now I get it. And I try to read the person and then figure out what is the best way to go about getting them to think of it without the conditioning and the brainwashing. So, no, that was
yeah.
Good.
I guess the thing that makes it a challenge is that, you know, 9/11 you can kind of, you know, plant a seed and you can take a bit of time because it's already been 20 years. But when you're not allowed to go to most public places, your rights are being taken away, kind of in the present. You maybe don't want to spend, you know, months kind of slowly bringing people along. You want to tell people that this is, you know, outrageous, that people's right to move around is being taken away. And
believe me, sometimes I'm not politics. Sometimes I don't care. It depends on the person, the situation I'm in. Or I might just read it that I don't have the opportunity, like you're kind of describing. But
yeah,
what you're saying, you're personalizing this to where this is an immediate problem for you, and so you want to deal with it in the immediate present. But you know, are the people you're talking to, are they having any impact on creating the situation, you think, or are they just followers?
Well, they're just followers, but they're, you know, there are people who, you know, some of them I've known for, you know, 30 or 40 years who are kind of attacking me as if I'm like their enemy instead of, you know, a very long-term friend. And they think I'm just so terribly selfish. And so I'm trying to think, what argument can I make that will make them see that I actually am concerned about everybody's rights, not just whether I personally can do this or that. I'm just sort of searching for that, you know.
So
that
I have a podcast to recommend to you. If Cheryl, if you can forward me an email address, I got something
I will.
To listen
okay.
to.
Yep.
Great. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Okay, so thank you so much, Tom, for your presentation and for answering all our questions, and hopefully we'll have you on again at some point for some of your other work. I know you're also writing a book on 9/11, so maybe one day when you're finished with that, we'll have you come on and share that with us also. So So, okay, and Richard Gage and Barbara Honegger have now joined us. So, again, thank you, Tom. And let's is it everyone okay if we any objections to skipping the announcements and going right in with Richard Gage's speech presentation?
I second the motion.
All right, thank you. All right, so that doesn't sound like anyone objects. So let me put us into lecture mode again. Let me unmute. Okay, so Richard or Barbara, do either of you have anything you want to say before Richard's presentation? I didn't know, Barbara, you wanted to say anything, or you're just here to listen, or are you unmuted, Barbara? All right, well, she's unmuted according to my screen, but I'm not hearing anything. So let's just go on with it. I'm going to put us into Q&A mode then, or into lecture mode. Not sure what's going on there. And now I will unmute Richard. Oh, you're unmuted. Okay. So this is not working well, this. So some people are muted and some aren't. So I don't know. And I know in the past people have told me they were muted when it showed they weren't. So let me just do this again. Okay. So, again, let me unmute Barbara in case she wanted to say something. And let me
Can you hear me, Cheryl?
Yeah, now I can, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted, it's Barb. I just wanted to say... after Richard talked about his situation with A&E, then I would appreciate having an announcement. And then Richard, I'm sure, will want to comment on that announcement.
Okay, so do you want to do that before we have the Q&A or after?
After.
Q&A on what?
Richard will answer questions, and then you want to Richard is saying after.
That's up to Richard. Ask him if he'd like to have the Q&A after my announcement or before.
Oh, after
Richard, what
would you? Yeah, you can do Barb first.
Okay, so you're going to present, and then Barb is going to make an announcement, and then we're going to end the Q&A. Okay, all right,
yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
So, great. So, Richard, then I'm just going to introduce you here, and I know you don't need an introduction with anyone in this group, but I'm just going to do it anyway. So Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect of 30 years. He's the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and he's now acting independently. He continues to lead the charge toward a new investigation into the destruction of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. He's delivered his live multimedia presentation, Blueprint for Truth, more than 700 times in dozens of foreign countries and 110 American cities to audiences ranging from 100 to 4,000. He's appeared on more than 600 radio and television spots. And Richard, go ahead, take it away.
Thank you, Cheryl, and hi, everybody. I'm sorry I couldn't get here earlier to hear the earlier speakers, but I was in a very important meeting. I just wanted to share with you the journey that I've been on over the last, year, because it was a year ago that Spike Lee contacted us. He's a famous director, and... we were just overjoyed to be flown to his studio in Brooklyn, and he filmed me for 2 hours almost, and I just let out the evidence, and he was blown away. He was blown away by other experts that we provided him and family members, and the stories. He was deeply moved and sincerely on board. With wanting to get the 9/11 truth out there. And so what happened? This was a two-hour, one of four two-hour segments that was to air on HBO, and it did, but only 90 minutes of the final segment aired, absent our 30 minutes. So what happened? Early in September, I think it was even August, Slate Magazine did some deep reporting in an effort to slam me and AE 9/11 Truth. And What they found was an obscure interview that I had done in a hallway in a conspiracy conference where I was kind of caught off guard and spoke outside of the area of expertise that I have developed and outside of the area that the 3,500 architects and engineers that I represent expect me to speak on, and that is the World Trade Center evidence, the destruction of the three skyscrapers. And what did I say? And it's not the first time I have said this, and that's part of the problem here also, because I've done a lot of research on my own about COVID and come up with strong feelings about it as I had 9/11. So these feelings found their way into the internet, and Slate magazine published them. I said, for instance, that this is on August 24th, and I said that COVID was a deep state false flag operation, and that the vaccines were likely to kill us, something like that. Pretty off topic for me, I also talked about Bill Gates. This all took as much time as I'm taking right now to explain it. It's not like I gave a lecture on the thing or anything, but it was enough to be picked up by Slate and put in the face of Spike Lee, who, by the way, had been getting a lot of pressure from the powers that be, and because it was already apparent out there that he was giving conspiracy theorists the platform that they have been looking for decades now, and on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and Spike spent a lot of time and effort supporting the official story, if you will, of COVID-19 in the first 2 hours or even more of his miniseries called Epicenter, New York Epicenter. So he's invested in the official story. He's invested in getting black people in New York vaccinated, and that's just a mission that he had. And so my comments were taken by him undoubtedly as undermining his own mission. So that's a key problem. And we know this because Tony Zambodi, one of our engineers, had a conversation with him in which Spike disclosed that, yes, this was the reason I pulled this segment. I didn't hear that directly from Tony. I heard it through the grapevine. Anyway, this was just an epic loss for all of us in the 9/11 truth movement. Myself, probably the most, because I'm responsible for this loss, and it weighed on me heavily. I have been to hell and back. This just floored me. I mean, literally. It floored our staff and our board as well. Nobody had worked more and harder on this than Ted Walter on our team. And all of a sudden, this opportunity just evaporated from us. And so everybody was hurt. Everybody was angry. I was mortified. The publicist that we have hired to help us get into mainstream media had given conflicting advice, but ultimately saying that the CEO has to step down. So there's a resolution on our board put forth that I resign, and there were many of us, three of us or so that argued against that resolution. That's not the solution. This is overreaction, a knee-jerk response. This is not a emergency that the publicist is presenting it as. The other side argued that this will haunt us forever, that these statements could come back at any time, the next time we get close to a mainstream media breakthrough. And so that's the reason that the CEO has to step down. I didn't agree with that. Others didn't. Nevertheless, after a rather vicious, not vicious, energetic debate, we lost, and I was not only let go as CEO, but my employment was terminated with AE911 Truth. That was the biggest blow forever. I mean, this has been my baby. 15 years I created and have nurtured with a whole lot of help, AE911 Truth. And so now, what do I do now? I'm like a fish out of water, and am I going to retire? I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to do anything, to tell you the truth. But as I realized and talked to people, it became clear after a couple of weeks that I'm not done. My mission is not done. I've got a lot of life left in me, and I'm going to get out there and do something. You know, I've now lost some credibility, not just because of my statements, but I've lost the 3,500 architects and engineers that I represented. I've lost the organization that I was speaking on behalf of. What can I do by myself out there? Well, I just took it upon myself to write the letter that's sitting right in the front of the new website that I created for the purpose of documenting the letter. And the letter tells the story that I'm telling now in some other pieces. And lo and behold, I got more positive feedback. I mean, 99% positive feedback. People agreeing with me that this is a severe overreaction. And I collected those comments because I needed to, for my own ego, for one thing, because it was severely crushed, but also just to convince myself and just show others that there is support out there, that I have a name that people will, a reputation that people will still listen to, and that I can continue and should continue to speak. There's many, many dozen of such comments that we've collected and put on the website in a second article. My goal was to stay on the board and help train the additional speakers that we were going to, that 8911 Truth was going to bring up, because the whole point was to have not one figurehead that's so vulnerable to such a thing, which is a great idea on the part of our CEO, on the part of the new CEO at 8911 Truth, Roland Angle, whom we all have a great deal of respect and affection for. And he has stepped up to the plate and given interviews, along with Andy Steele, who's given some great interviews, including InfoWars. So there's still a lot of talent left at 8911 Truth, and 8911 Truth has to survive. It is the tip of the spear of the 9/11 Truth movement, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make damn sure that it not only survives but thrives. And I'm sending, well, I decided to continue speaking after all of this, and that's what my website does. It presents me as a speaker and interviewer. I'm not stopping. And so it became clear in the last board meeting that I had a part in that that was a bit of a conflict of interest, and so I needed to be not on the board if I'm having my own, if you will, quasi-competition going on with the 9/11 Truth. I don't see it as competition at all. I see myself as a kind of a speaker out there that says, hey, look, they got the 3,500 architects and engineers. You know, what are you going to deal with that? Deal with it. So I'm now completely detached, unaffiliated with 9/11 Truth. We left on as good of terms as one could hope for under such tragic circumstances. I will be presenting the evidence, and I will be helping people to be pointed toward where they can purchase it in bulk and get it out to the public, the media, the elected representatives, the academic institutions, and engineers and architects, the whole profession. That's the goal. So it remains my goal. And to achieve that goal, I'm instituting some changes in my own professional activities. I'm going to start a weekly podcast. I'm going to have guests on, starting with the subjects of World Trade Center, including Kevin Ryan, David Ray Griffin, Stephen Jones, and others. Fran Schur on the psychology of 9/11. She's now written an essay on the psychology of 9/11, paralleling the psychology of COVID-19. So I'm going to interview her about that too. Kevin Ryan has paralleled the inception and operation of 9/11 to the inception and operation and censorship and cover up of COVID. So I'm not going to stay in the nice nest that I built for myself. I don't seem capable of doing it anyway. So I'm going to be stretching my wings and flying a little bit higher. So you can find me. We're starting tonight. In fact, we're going to be live streaming our first podcast, which will be essentially me, really, just explaining my history and this story. And so then we'll go on next week to other guests, and I'll be lining them up. I'll be looking for a lot of help, because now, guess what? I don't have six staff anymore. I've got my wife, who's doing a great job, but she's got a full-time job. So I'm asking people to support my work. I don't know what my financial condition will be. That remains undecided as of yet in terms of my financial relationship with 9/11 Truth. I'm asking people to subscribe to my weekly podcast, which is $7 a month. Or as a founding member, $300 a year. I really need the support to keep on doing what I do best. And everybody seems to believe that I do a very good job at what I do. And I intend to continue doing it, but I can't without your support. So please send out the Richard Gage 911.org website URL. Out there, so people can at least know, A, what happened, you know, at 9/11 Truth, and B, support me, give me your ideas, help, let me know who I should be interviewing. And we're also going to make a new film on the World Trade Center evidence. And Mickey Willis is on board, and he's committed. He's the filmmaker of Plandemic 1 and 2. So that starts next month. And that, I'll be campaigning for funds for that project as well. That will be substantially me giving a presentation to a large architecture firm that will be filmed, and there'll be other interviews associated with that, and lots of our evidence that we're all familiar with. So that's what I'm going to be up to, and that's where I came from, and that's all I wanted to share with you to this point. I think Barbara had some comments, too.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. And before we get to the Q&A, we'll hear from Barbara. Barbara, you're unmuted. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have a major announcement. The reason that we were, both Richard and I, were late on this call, later than we had planned, is because as of 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock p.m., no, let's see, as of 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock p.m., West Coast time, which Richard and I are both on. He's in Idaho. I'm in California. Tonight was Richard's first meeting as a new member of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry Board. And we are just ecstatic that he has agreed to join us. The energy just went up, 1,000%. And we had a wonderful meeting. Got more done than we've ever gotten done in a meeting in years. I've been with the Lawyers Committee now almost 6 years. And, if anybody has any questions about that, I'd be happy to answer those as well. But I want to go back to Richard.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. So let me put it into Q&A mode here. And let's see.
And thank you, Barb, for mentioning that and for the whole committee on the board at Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Maybe I'm not a lawyer, but I will. I am capable of technical advice, and that's what I have been brought on to do. So I'm just honored. It's like somebody's kind of picking me up after I've been kicked out of one nest and sort of into another.
Right now you've accumulated another board. Lucky you.
Yeah.
Okay, Richard, I'm going to put you in Q&A mode. And let me make sure you're unmuted. I'm going to unmute Barbara there, too. And let's see. Okay, so Richard, you're unmuted. And while we're waiting for people to get in the queue, it's star six, everyone, if you want to have some comments for Richard or some questions. And while we're waiting for that, Richard, I just want to say that I don't think you've lost any credibility, at least you haven't in my book. And I'm of the belief that HBO would never have aired that segment anyway, because they've never aired anything in the last 20 years, and they've never done anything with Martin Luther King or the Kennedy assassination, so that was at all truthful. So I don't think they would have done it anyway. That's my opinion. And I'm sorry that the board didn't support you at AE. I think that would have been really helpful to have been supported in that, because, in the role that you're in, you're going to be attacked by people. They want to discredit you. So anyway, those are my comments, and let's move on to our first question.
I'd like to jump in kind of whenever you want to leave me in there, Cheryl. Doesn't matter when.
Okay, I already have my finger on the button, and if I pull it,
sure.
Yep.
No, go ahead.
You can go right after Tom, okay? Here's Tom Wilcutz. Sure. Tom, go ahead.
Good evening, Richard. I share your view about COVID being a false flag, which was my presentation earlier. And actually, you and I, you probably don't remember, but we met some time ago. In a hallway at a conference. I didn't tape it like happened to you with the slate. I think Cheryl introduced us at the Deep State Conference way back in, I think it was 2010. But in any case, the question I have, and I have a comment too, I share Cheryl's opinion about what would have happened with Spike Lee's efforts. But my question is, it seems to me that for the board to do what they did, the one potential justification for taking such action would be to correct things with Spike, say, okay, so you have this problem with Richard, but he's no longer with us. We have an alternative person who can supply the material that he supplied, so let's hold on to this project. So my question is, was any effort made along those lines?
Well, there was no time for Spike to do any major editing. The best he could come up with in the end was to cut the whole segment, and very, very tragic, but that explains it to my satisfaction.
Well, it just seems to me that if he really were committed to it, I mean, it's something he could have released in another fashion. But the comment I have along those lines is there was another effort that's similar to what you're describing, and I don't know how many people recall this, but years ago, Mark Cuban was also moved, I guess, by seeing the film Loose Change, and he decided that other Americans should see it too, and he took it upon himself to finance it being shown in theaters throughout the country. And he got heavy pushback and from one of the Fox talking heads. I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head. He was the one who got in a sexual problem and had to resign. But in any case, the SEC went after Mark Cuban. They and this is one of the things I do in my job is I've handled insider trading cases. In fact, I was involved in insider trading investigations that took place in World Trade Center 7 before 9/11. But the case against Cuban was completely, it was a joke. It was completely contrived, but it succeeded. Well, he never connected the dots himself publicly, but the fact of the matter is he was gonna finance Loose Change in theaters. The SEC went after him. He then later dropped that project, and the SEC dropped his case. So I sort of agree with Cheryl that I don't think the existence of this Slate magazine attack on you would have been the only bullet that they would have fired to get that result. I mean, if they went after Spike with more than that, I don't know if he would. I mean, it's easy for him to say that this was enough, and maybe it was enough, but either way, if it wasn't enough, they would have come at him with more, and it's very likely they did that anyway. And if it's the kind of stuff that would dissuade him, it's not the kind of stuff he could probably discuss publicly in any case. But you were closer to it, so you might have a better a take on that. But I would reflect back on, I mean, Mark Cuban is certainly a powerful individual. And he was stopped in his tracks when he was doing something similar, which is bringing this question to the public. And he actually said the same thing. He said, look, I think this is just something the public should see and they can decide for themselves. He tried to be neutral on it, and that's what happened. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Okay, and then Craig, you wanted to comment?
Yeah. Hi, Richard. How's it going?
Hey, Greg.
Hey. Before I ask my question, I just wanted to say thank you to you and to say how much I enjoyed our time working together. And you know, I'm sorry for everything that happened, obviously.
I appreciated
absolutely.
All your hard work and great writing.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the fact that you know that you brought me on as a volunteer back in 2014, and so I appreciated your support and confidence at the time. So anyway,
want to get that out of the way.
A whirlwind of trouble, too.
Well, there's never any much time goes by without trouble, I guess, in the movement of one kind or another. I guess we have to roll with it, I suppose. Now, I do want to ask. I'm not going to ask any AE questions. It's not, it's not appropriate. I'm just going to speak as myself. I am kind of curious, since you're now kind of free to speak about any topic you like. I know for a fact that there has always been intense pressure on leaders in the movement to endorse this idea of a 757 hitting the Pentagon. And I know you've always stayed neutral on that because of the requirements, the AE requirements. But now that you're not, constrained that way, what I'm wondering and also concerned about is that I'm concerned about the possibility of pressure being brought to bear, and I'm thinking about how really, what bad news it would be if you were to add yourself to the effort that, you know, we both know what I mean when I say that, the effort that's lobbying for a 757 impact. So I guess I'd like to know, what are your preliminary thoughts about whether you will take a position on that at some point, and you know, the concern that might be raised by some about you know, certain people kind of putting the pressure on you to go over to their side or to, you know. So
well,
I guess that's it.
I get pressure from both sides of this three-part equation, actually. I did have some preliminary thoughts, Craig, and my idea is that, gosh, people really care about what I think, probably way too much, especially Spike Lee. But what if in this weekly podcast, I say, okay, well, let's find out who shows up for such a set of interviews. I interview the CIT side, say you, and you just have an opportunity to present the evidence, and then I interview the other side, say David Chandler, and he has an opportunity not to bash you and not vice versa, but to present his evidence, and interview Barbara Honegger, who seems to be the third leg of this contentious debate on the Pentagon, or at least a different set of evidence, and just let people ask intelligent questions if I'm capable, and to the extent that I'm capable, and let people kind of decide themselves. I have no intention of taking a side, to answer your question directly and bluntly. But I have toyed with the idea of not only doing what I just suggested, but maybe, depending on the success of that, if we do it, host a debate where I would be responsible, gullibly so perhaps, keep it on a scientific basis and keep people from throwing things at each other.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and I'm glad to hear that you're going to sort of stay neutral, because I can just see the potential for problems. So I definitely you know, it's something to talk about for sure. Thank you.
So that's why I signed up, by the way, over there on your site, so that I could suggest such a debate, but I don't think I was approved.
I think we just got a bit of a backlog there, and that's my fault, Richard. I've kind of just not been completely up to date with a couple of different groups that I'm involved in running, so my apologies for that.
We can't hear you very well, Craig. You're dying out.
I'm sorry. I had the speaker on. That's the reason why.
That's
yeah, yeah. I know there's a couple of questions I think you're supposed to answer before you join the group, so I'm not sure if you did, but in any case, we will get you responded as quickly as possible, for sure.
Okay, yeah, I might need a little help answering those questions, because I got stumbled upon there.
Well, you can say I don't know, I suppose, if you want to.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much, Richard.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it so much.
Okay, great. Thanks, Craig. And then the next question is coming from Nita Renfrew. Nita, go ahead.
Oh, is that me, for me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I'm Nita Renfrew, and you're one of my heroes, Richard.
Oh, my goodness.
We met briefly down at Ground Zero once. And I want to say that my image of you now is that you are a bird who has fledged from the nest, and you're now free to fly any place you want, high and mighty. You're no longer protected by Mama Bird and Papa Bird. And I think you're going to find, I think eventually you're going to find that this is a godsend. One of the things that comes to mind when you talked about this is that it hasn't been lost on a lot of us that COVID and the whole crisis and lockdown and so on is really a continuation. It's really an outcome of 9/11. And it occurs to me, and I can't think of who right now, but I think you can find somebody who can speak to that and interview them on your podcast. Because this whole thing started, you know, with 9/11 and then the Patriot Act and all of that sort of thing. And so they're not disconnected. And since you have Mickey Willis, you know, doing your film now, I mean, it's like, it's just obvious that there's a connection there. So I have great hopes for you and much support for you. And I'm actually very happy for you that you've been freed.
I haven't gotten to the happy part yet.
I know, it takes a while. It takes a while.
I have about 14 paid subscribers at the $7 a month rate. So I can assure you that at this rate, I won't be able to fly. But I'm not giving up. I'm going to see if, in fact, it just takes more time and more skill on my part with social media, because I didn't even know what a hashtag was. We have experts that do these kinds of things for us at 8. They have experts that do these kinds of things at 8911 Truth. See, I don't even know who I am anymore. I still think I'm wearing the under the mama bird, and yet I've been kicked out of the nest, and I don't know who I am outside of 8911 Truth. I don't even know how to speak for myself. So I got a steep learning curve in all kinds of ways ahead of me.
It'll be very exciting. But rest assured that you are on the right side of history now.
Oh, thank you.
And that's important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Nita. Next is a question from Ann Hendricks. Ann, go ahead.
Gosh, Richard, it's Anne. I'm just going to say two things really quick. A couple years ago, when you were planning the anniversary, I guess the 18th anniversary, you talked about it, and one of our folks on the call, who might be on the call right now, said, I don't know if there's going to be anything there for me. I know all of that already, and I get kind of tired of it. And you responded to her that, yeah, you've been talking about that over and over and over, Building 7, and over and over and over. This is your chance. So you've been set free from that, definitely. Another thing is a quote that was a life motto of mine since I was 18, to venture is to risk one's life, and not to venture is to lose it. But my real comment here, question is, I wrote to you about Spike Lee, about what is the real issue there. And I think right now the immediate issue is that he needs educating, because he is trying to influence the minority communities, African American communities or whomever, that that they need to get the vaccine. And if there is a way that if you can somehow educate him, if you can turn him around that might be at the heart of what is going on. Maybe this happened because they didn't want Spike Lee to get too close to the truth about many things. So I know you haven't had any time to think about that in the last few days, but I think it is very immediate that he's pushing it, and those people are in danger right now. So, anyway.
Well, eventually Spike is going to realize what COVID is all about, and we all are, and because it's Pandora's box, and it's been opened with the vaccines, and it's just a matter of time. And so anyway, I have a fantasy that Spike will get upset with himself for having made that decision and leak the 30-minute segment. I don't know what good that'll do us at that time. But anyway, it's a fantasy of mine.
Well, there might be an opening for you with some minority communities to educate them about COVID and about other false plagues. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you, Ann.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Next we have Peter Ketchum. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Hey, yes. Peter, how you doing?
Hi, Richard.
Hey.
So I probably, like a lot of people, I didn't know what had happened until, you know, this evening when you gave your explanation. I knew something had happened because Roland had sent out an email that, you know, it's kind of cryptic, and something had happened. So thanks for your explanation. And, you know, I pretty much agree with you on everything you said. And I still support you just as much as ever. So I don't really have a question. So I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Well, that means a lot to me. Your video that you made for us, that we made for you, is I hear again and again and again how struck people are by your sincerity, your depth, and not just being an insider from NIST, speaking out as a whistleblower, really. But you're just dear to all of our hearts who have seen your video. And gosh, tell me the name of it. Why am I spacing so people can
stand
see
for the,
what we're
stand
talking
for the
about?
Truth. Stand for the truth.
Stand for truth, yeah. And that's what you did. You stood for the truth. This isn't your hour, but I hope maybe you can quickly answer the question. I don't know how, but what price have you paid for standing for the truth?
None. I haven't paid any
yeah?
price. Yeah, I mean,
wow.
It'd probably be easy to think that, you know, I lost friends or family members rejected me. Nothing.
Wow.
If anything, it was actually very quiet. I actually heard very little from others. And it has never caused me any trouble at all. You know, and this December, it'll be 5 years. We did that. We recorded that, filmed that December 2016. So a few more months can be 5 years. And, you know, I can see now, although I felt it right at the time, but I definitely can see now that participating in Stand for the Truth was one of the best things I did with my life. It's one of the best things I ever did.
Wow.
So you get the credit for that because you and Ted are the ones who invited me. So, you know, congrats to you on that. And, I'm going to be supporting you now going forward just like I did before.
Totally awesome. And Ted did 99% of the work on that. So let's give the credit where that's
yeah.
due.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
He's kind of the master behind the scenes there. And Kelly David does 90% of the 99% of all the work that Ted doesn't do. Those two are the powerhouse there, and they will keep AE 9/11 Truth running for years and decades, if need be. We hope it doesn't take that long. But I'm not there to fuck things up anymore. And so hopefully, you know, they can get something in the mainstream media there. I'll be rooting from the outside with everything I got.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks again for giving your explanation tonight. I know I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. So that's the end of our questions, Richard. And I do want to congratulate you on being now a member of the Lawyers Committee Board. Congratulations on that. So you're already flying, it looks like. So
thank you.
Thanks again. And I don't know if you or Barbara had anything else either of you wanted to share.
Could I make one last comment?
Sure.
Yeah. I would just like to encourage everybody. I think you heard what Richard said, that he can't fly without donations. And he only has, I think he said, 14 people at $7. I am making a major contribution to Richard. And anyone, what I'm asking everyone to do, do as much as you can. Richard, what is your website? Where can people donate or become subscribers to your podcast again?
RichardGage911.org.
Right. Okay. A heartfelt request to act on your support of Richard. He desperately needs income right now. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, thank you, Barbara, and thank you, Richard. Thank you for sharing your story with us. I know that must have been difficult to go through and experience and talk about. So we're all behind you, it sounds like, and anytime you want to come on and share more updates with us, please let me know.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. Sure. You guys take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, so let me take us out of Q&A mode and put us into unmuted mode. Okay, so this brings us to our section where we're talking about announcements, events, any topic that anyone wants to bring up. Anyone want to say anything?
Yes, I want to. Barb, when you're all done, I have an announcement.
Okay, who was that?
Fern. I wanted to talk.
Okay, go ahead, Fern.
Oh, yeah, I was trying to talk to Richard. I would support him $7 a month. I don't have credit cards, but I would love to support him $7 a month for his podcast. I remember when I came into my 9/11 truth group in the beginning with Wes Jameson, I saw Wally Rodriguez with his lawyer, like that was the first time I went. And then I would go to St. Mark's every Sunday. And I remember the first time that Richard came to our group and he handed out, which I still have, back-to-back copies, one on World Trade Center and the other on the Twin Towers. And about a third of my apartment is filled with 9/11 communications and then the beginning of this pandemic. And I just wanted to say about both of them affect our schools, our transportation. On one of the, this past Monday, one of the teachers got up representing a lot of other teachers, and she would not have her job unless she submitted to taking a vaccination. And she's not alone. So, and then she wouldn't get unemployment also. So what the government is doing, and like after 9/11, the same thing, you know, our mayor did No Child Left Behind so that, you know, we had to be tested. The same kind of things going on. So if Richard will tell me how I support him $7 a month, I can do it with cash. I can send it to him and be part of the podcast. I'd love to do that. You know,
do you have an email that you could give, or I'm sure that Cheryl has it. Cheryl, could you get her email to Richard and vice versa to put them together?
Sure.
Here's my email. It's Richard.
You're still on, Richard. I didn't know you were still on. Okay.
Yeah, it's Richard at richardgage911.org. Richard at richardgage911.org. We'll figure something out, Fern. Thank you so much.
Okay, all set, Fern?
Yeah, okay.
Richard Gage911.org.
Richard at richardgage911.org.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and Barbara, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I'd just like people to know how delighted and ecstatic really we are to have Richard on the Lawyers Committee Board. It's going to make a huge difference. It's a new chapter for him and for the Lawyers Committee, and we're very excited about it and very honored. I know he said he's honored to be on the Lawyers Committee, but he's not the only non-lawyer on the Lawyers Committee. I'm not a lawyer, though I was a, you know, top Justice Department official, but I'm not a lawyer, and neither is Christina Borgeson, who is this, you know, master investigator. She's our director of investigations. She spent over 15 years of her life and produced the magnificent documentary TWA Flight 800 that proved at least two, if not three, missiles took down TWA Flight 800, and she is our director of investigation. So there are now three of us who are non-attorneys, and there are four attorneys on the board. So, Rich is not alone being up against all these legals. I am as well. But the announcement that I wanted to make is that this Sunday, I'm not sure the date, but anyway, it's this Sunday, on a global radio show, which Richard and I have been on many times, but this Sunday, the radio show, online radio show, is called The Other Side of Midnight, and I'll tell you who's going to be on it here in a minute. If you're interested, you would go to theothersideofmidnight.com. It begins at 9 p.m. West Coast time, and midnight, that's why it's called The Other Side of Midnight, midnight East Coast time for 3 hours. And but it's going to be worth it if you can stay up there on the East Coast. It's going to be Danny Sheehan, the world famous attorney, and myself and Richard Hoagland, who was the science advisor to Walter Cronkite for a decade on the entire science aspect of things. And so the three of us for 3 hours are going to be talking about 9/11, COVID, the JFK assassination, and the seamless links really between all of them. So that's going to be, we're going to be at an eagle's eye view of the history and also get down into the details. So I hope you can join us. If you are interested, theothersideofmidnight.com, and when you open that website in the upper left-hand corner, close to the top, you would click on tonight's show, and you wouldn't want to go on it until about a minute after midnight. East Coast time, a minute after 9 p.m. West Coast time, and you click on tonight's show, and then wait a sec, and the next page that comes up is the page that has the banner, they call it. It's basically the icon, the image for the night, and it'll give our names, and there'll be some kind of related image. And you scroll down until you see how to listen. Sometimes it's not far scrolled down, sometimes it's a bit. But anyway, you just scroll down until you see the words how to listen. Click on that, and that will give you then options. And I highly recommend you can there will be a phone number that you can listen just by your phone. However, I recommend choosing the one that says words to the effect, use our own player or use our own audio player. It's audio only because it's online radio. And when you click on that, finally, the next page that opens is almost all black, and in the middle of the page is a little tiny red icon that's got an arrow in the lower left that you click on to start the playing of the audio. And you have to wait a few seconds before you start hearing the audio. So
So wait at least 10 seconds and the audio should come on. And I think it's going to be a great show. So we invite you to join us.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you for sharing that, Barbara. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And anybody else have anything they want to share or talk about? Okay. Let's see. Anybody? I had a book I want to recommend that I'm reading. It's called Seeking Truth in a Country of Lies, Critical and Lyrical Essays. It's by Edward Curtin, who frequently writes for Global Research. And it's a great book. It's very uplifting and speaks to all of us and all of our concerns. So, anybody else have anything? No? Okay, I guess that's it for tonight. Okay, thank you everybody for joining us, and we'll see you all next month.
Okay. Thanks, Cheryl.
Okay, good night. Bye.